today's Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'll be serving as the session moderator coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. In just a moment, I'll turn things over to your primary instructor today, Don Bussey, who joins us from EPA's Environmental Response Team. I'm going to walk through a few session reminders before we kick off our live broadcast. You should be here joining us for today's borehole geophysics as applied to bedrock hydrogeologic evaluations, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Environmental Response Team. Our live broadcast is scheduled to run from approximately 1 p.m. Eastern to 2:15 p.m. Eastern. I do have a few reminders that we'll walk through today. And again, for those of you that are new to the Internet seminars that we offer here through CLUIN, you should have a registration and reminder email in your inbox that have the instructions you'll need to join us for today's live broadcast. That email will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage, where you can read more about the session. You'll find contact information for your instructor as well as myself. There are even links to download copies of the presentation materials right from the seminar homepage. So if you're the kind of person who likes to page back and forth and take your own notes, I encourage you to download a copy of those slides electronically before joining us online. If you would like to, you can then click the Go to Seminar button that appears in the upper left corner of that screen, and that'll actually check you in online. It's going to ask you for your first and last name, as well as the number of people at your location, so that you can join us for our fully interactive Adobe Connect delivery. We will be using Adobe Connect for today's live broadcast. You'll be able to watch and listen in real time as our presenter walks through materials, including PowerPoint presentations and live video feeds. If you have problems joining us in Adobe Connect, we do have those materials available to download and replay locally, but I encourage you to let us know if you're having problems with Adobe Connect so we can try to troubleshoot those issues and get you on board for that fully interactive live web broadcast. Audio will be available two ways for today's broadcast. By default, you can listen to the session online using your computer speakers with a pair of headphones, or a pair of computer speakers. If you have problems with the online broadcast, check your local volume settings on your device. Sometimes you need to go into the sound control panel and increase your speaker output. You'll also need to be sure that that Adobe Connect audio icon is shaded bright green. If it's not, click it once to turn the online audio stream on. If that fails to solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. You can simply use the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right-hand corner, to request the call-in number. Just know if you join us on the phone lines, you will be placed on a global mute, and we ask that you remain on a global mute to cut down on other background noises and disruptions. We do have the Q&A window in the lower right-hand corner, which will be available throughout today's live broadcast that you can use to submit your comments, questions, and to report technical problems at any time. In fact, I encourage you to take a moment to test that Q&A window out now. Just let us know if you can hear and see things okay. That submission is private. Simply click on the empty box at the bottom of the Q&A window, type up your message, and then hit enter or press the cartoon bubble button to the right to privately submit your message in. We also do have an interactive survey that's available in the lower left half of your screen. We're going to close that now in just a moment. I just wanted to be sure that our instructor has had a moment to review the results. We've asked our participants to indicate how experienced they consider themselves with borehole geophysics. To cast your vote, if you're an audience member and you haven't done so, simply review the options and click on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply. I'm still seeing a few results pop in on the poll. It does look like about 59% of the audience has some experience. About 9% consider themselves very experienced, and about a third of our audience says they're not experienced with borehole geophysics. So we do appreciate that real-time distribution of votes. Okay, just another reminder, we are recording today's broadcast, and we are going to share a link to replay today's live seminar after our broadcast. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce those recordings, but you can certainly feel free to forward that recording on to anyone you think will find it a valuable expenditure of their time. And you can browse the nearly 600 recorded sessions we've hosted previously on CLUIN. Just a quick screenshot before I turn things over to our primary instructor today. Again, you should see a copy of the presentation materials, which will appear on the left-hand side of your screen. Our presenter will control movement, so these slides will change. We'll also be playing some live movie feeds through this window. If you have problems viewing that content, there's a button that appears in the upper right corner. It looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. That gives you a full screen option. If you click it once, it makes the slides bigger. If you click that four-arrowed icon again, it'll shrink the slides back down. You can feel free to go in and out of the full screen view as needed for your own viewing experience. You'll see our Clue-In logo in the upper right, a collection of related URLs. Again, you can find copies of the presentation materials on the seminar homepage, as well as included as a seminar resource. And then our interactive Q&A window here in the lower right. Type up your comments, questions, and report technical problems at any time here. We will take a break for Q&A with our instructor, and at that point, I'll read through questions so that he can verbally address them. But there's no need to wait. You can send them in as soon as they occur to you. I think that's the end of the technical reminders. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our primary instructor today, who's joining us again from EPA's Environmental Response Team. We're going to be joined for today's borehole geophysics webinar by Don Bussey. Don, if you're ready to begin, feel free.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. I want to welcome everybody. Thanks for calling in and participating. It looks like by the results of the polls, it's pretty much what I was expecting. A good amount of you are have some experience, and this will be beneficial for you. And those that have no experience, I think you'll learn a lot. And I've got some nice case studies and some nice drawings to show people. Even if you have some experience, maybe you'll benefit out of this. So I'll go to my next slide. I'm trying to find the yellow, the green arrow, Gene. There it is. Okay. I'm going to talk about what I consider common tools that I use a lot in hydrogeologic settings. They're certainly not the only tools. There are other tools, and there's other things in the oil and gas industry and other industries that are that I'm not going to be going into here. This is basically to go into groundwater assessments in bedrock settings. But a bonus, I do have some examples of some things that I've done in the oil patch, abandoning shallow oil wells. So that'll be at the end of the presentation. As far as the hydrogeological assessments, the tools that are listed there, there's eight of them. I would say that except for the natural gamma log, you need an open borehole. You might be able to use some of the tools in boreholes with long screen intervals, but I look at this suite of logs as something you would do if you came to a site and you didn't know much about it and you knew you had a bedrock issue, and you had some idea of the depth of your plume, and then you could use these tools to evaluate the geology and hydrogeology, and then continue on with your investigation. So I want to let you see this equipment as it is. It's very portable. You can have it shipped. You see that there's a tripod that a winch wire from a winch goes over and down the hole, operated from this motor, controlled by the computer, powered by the battery. All of this can be packed up and shipped. These are some of the tools, what they look like. Okay. And there's also geophysical borehole tools that are mounted in mobile vehicles. The one here on the upper left is actually doing some oil well work, and the other three photographs are showing the USGS borehole truck out of Troy, New York. You can see it can be operated at night and what the control panel looks like inside. So you can go that way or mobile. And the first tool is a pretty basic tool. It's a natural gamma log. And gamma logs are measuring the natural radioactive decay from the formation. Shales, fine-grained materials, have higher gamma counts, and limestones and sandstones have very lesser amounts of gamma counts. As it says here, it's useful for borehole correlation. And this can be used in both cased and uncased holes. But if you use it in a cased hole, it's going to be dampered a little bit. I'll show you a typical responses from gamma ray logging from 0 to 100 API units. You can see the shales have much higher, volcanic ash have much higher gamma counts, and your limestones, clean sand, have much less counts. So you can do some borehole to borehole correlations there with that. Another thing that it is useful for is if, and I found this next slide, it's not a real good one, but it illustrates my point. It's actually from a site somewhere in China, but I wanted to show you that you can actually look for and discern faulting via gamma logging. Looking for my, there it is. If you drill a borehole right here, you would see this layer here. And if you drill a hole over here, you'd see this layer again. This would be pretty much your normal stratigraphic column. But if you drilled your hole here, you see there's a fault, and you would see a repeat section. So something, another use for gamma logs. Temperature logging, that's what I use it for, is to look, try to find out where in the open borehole you may have water either coming in or out of the hole. You might have situations such as this. This log, you'll be seeing this this display several times in this presentation. This is some USGS proprietary software where they use to present their logs. But here's your gamma log. Where is it? There it is. Here's your gamma log here. And you can, this is pretty much just a straight carbonate section, so you're not getting much differences. But you can tell that USGS picked this formation based on this kick. And pretty much down here, same thing, formation pick based on this kick here. Temperature log, in this case, the water level in this well is at 115 feet. So your gamma, your temperature logging is when it hits the water table or the stable static level in the well, you're going to see a difference in temperature usually. And as you progress downwards, it increases slightly until right here where there's something going on. Let's bear that in mind when we come back to the slide later. But again, it's a very delicate temperature increase, 49.5 degrees to 50.5 degrees Fahrenheit. There's 1 degree there, okay? Caliper logging is a mechanical tool that's lowered into the hole, and this is how it's lowered in, with the arms tight to the tool. And then when you get to depth, you open up the tool, these arms open, and then you would come up hole with that. And what it's measuring is those arms are spring activated, and they respond to the borehole diameter. So the bigger the diameter, the wider the spacing. Okay, so it's going to help you try to find some voids or fractures. Like, for instance here, this is a mechanical caliper, 5 inches to 10 inches. This is another caliper. It's an acoustic caliper that's derived from the acoustic televiewer logs, and I'll talk about those later, but you can see you've got some big kicks here. These are fractures in the rock, and it has some relationship to what you're seeing in these other logs, but we'll go into that later. So by using a caliper, you can identify some fractures. Now, highly inclined vertical fractures you're not going to see with a caliper, mechanical caliper. They just don't, the opening is that doesn't increase that much. And let's see, electrical conductivity. It does a lot of the same things that you get from a gamma log in your clays and silts. You get a more conductive or less conductive response. Sands and gravels, you have more less conductivity. This would be more conductivity here, less conductivity here. So it can help you to do a little formation analysis. Okay. And this was a case study that a colleague of mine at USGS, or I'm sorry, EPA ran. And it's a conductivity log, but as you can see, there's four distinct runs, time one through time four, which is N, one through four. And you can see over time, the conductivity increases. What we were seeing here is a plume moving, a movement of a plume. So that's kind of an interesting application as well for conductivity logs. Borehole video logging is pretty useful. This is a tool here that the lights aren't illuminated right now, but this particular tool just looks basically straight down. It's useful for looking for fractures and voids and also blockages in boreholes if you might be having troubles with getting tools down, you know, sampling devices and things like that down the hole. This is another unit that also looks straight down. It's from a friend of mine's. It's Southwest Florida Water Management District. And you can see it's pretty bright. And again, it's looking straight down. This is an example. I think I missed a slide. No. This is an example of some of the images that you can get, still images that you can get from a borehole video logger. In this case here, you see some cascading groundwater. So water is cascading into the well, but it doesn't fill up. So that tells me it's leaving the well somewhere too. Blockage. Blockage. And some remnants of drilling operations. This is a base of a casing, I think. Another couple of images. The reason I selected these two images is that it's a difference between a cored borehole, and this is at 177 feet, and a air hammer hole, a little rougher. See some cascading water there too. Okay. this is a borehole video. And Gene is going to launch it. Just to give you an example of what some of these things look like. And I think I have another borehole that's appended to the end. Here's a real rough hole. You can see it was air hammered and it's just all beat up. But these are the types of images that you can obtain with borehole logging, a video logging. Okay, going back. Trying to advance. It's not letting me advance. Gene? there we go. This is another camera. I just want to make sure that I didn't miss another slide. I don't seem to be having control over this.
Go ahead. Arrow keys in the lower left of your screen.
Okay, I got it. Okay, this is another downhole video camera that can be run in a borehole, and you can see this isn't looking straight down. This is looking at the borehole wall, and in this case, the I lost my green arrow. Now, you can see how it looks out towards the borehole wall. We've actually seen Dean Apple in boreholes weeping out of a fracture, and you can see that you can see it running. You could see it in the sense it's running down the borehole wall. So, valuable tool that you can use in certain situations. This is the same tool, but this shown stationary and illuminated, and you can see how portable it is. Again, from my friend in Southwest Florida. All right. Now, these next two logs I'm going to discuss are pretty interesting, and I've been using them for about 10 years now, but I still find people that haven't been exposed to them. It's an optical and acoustic televiewing. And what a televiewing log is, it can either be optical, which is basically pictures of the borehole wall, images, or they can be acoustic, which is we bounce a signal off the borehole wall. It comes back. How long it takes to return is proportional to the distance to the reflector. And you can get some nice pictures of fractures and things like that within the borehole. I'll forward it to one right now. take a look at it. Oh, this is another video. This is an acoustic televiewer, and you can see when it launches. Okay. Signal off the wall. It keeps spinning, and as you're lowering the tool down the well or the borehole, it's compiling the reflectors, and it results in an image that looks something like, I'm still having trouble, something like this. This is the acoustic televiewer log, and I'm trying to find, and you can see there's 0 degrees, which is north, 90 is east, 180 is south, etc., until it goes back to north. So how these, and the same thing for the optical televiewer, 90, 0 to 180, back to 0. A couple things I'd like to point out with these logs. The first thing is, right, this is noise. This is where logging starts, and as you can see with the acoustic televiewer, it corresponds with the static water level in the borehole. You need to have fluid in the well in order for the signal to propagate and come back. The optical log is more or less pictures, so what you see is a clear picture here, and you can see how it's a little bit more cloudy here because it's seeing suspended sediment or clays that are that have been suspended into the water column. So I like to run both of these logs. You get a real good color picture here, which is, and you can see, remember this fracture zone that we looked at with the caliper log here and here? You're seeing those same features in both logs, okay? You see the sinusoidal curve here? What that's doing is telling us that we've got something crossing the borehole. Let me just step back one more time and talk about the 0 to 0. How these logs are run is that they're run, the tool is actually has a compass, and north is known, so the compass bearing is known. So no matter how the tool might twist in the well, north is always where it's supposed to be. And what we basically do is take a vertical and we slice it right down north. So you have north here, south in this region here. So if you picture a tube, you're just slicing it down a known length of the tube and opening it up, okay? Hopefully you can see that. One of the things you can tell here is that if you know the borehole diameter, you get that from the caliper, and you should know it from what you drilled anyway, approximately. And you see the dip of a fracture here, you know the borehole diameter, you know the distance from here to here, okay, and you know where north is, you can work out strike and dip of the of whatever's passing through the hole, or the fractures in the formation. So some pretty useful tools. I like to run them both because I want to see what's above the water, not just what's below it. And sometimes you see a better picture with the acoustic below the water table than you do with an optical. Okay. Now here's our primary example here. And you can remember how we had the temperature log here. We had some type of a kick right here. You see the caliper openings goes from just over 3 inches to between 8 and 9 inches. And you can see that same opening in the acoustic and optical televiewer tools responses. Okay. So these are very good depictive tools to try to understand what the geology is. Now we'll talk a little bit about borehole flow. Vertical borehole flow. And everyone knows if you open up a deep uncased well that there's potential for vertical movement, whether that be upward or downward, and whether or not that's enhancing the potential for vertical cross-contamination if you're in a setting where you might have contaminants. Now, there's other logging tools besides a heat pulse flow meter. When you have a big vertical flow, usually you look at some types of flow meter logs that have impellers, so that the amount of how fast the impellers turn is proportional to the flow. But in this case, we're measuring slow flow, which is, I think, more common in at least the geologic settings I've worked in. And this heat pulse flow meter will go down to as low as 0.10 gallons per minute. Now, how it works is, here's your depiction of the tool. Here's your stabilizers to keep the tool center in the hole, and that's basically what these features are. Okay, there's your centralizers, again, right here, okay? What you have is a heating grid with a temperature sensor above and below the heating grid. And here, the heating grid would be right there, and your sensors would be here and here. And then close up, your sensors are here, here, and this is where your heating element is. Now, this centralizer is keeping tight to the formation wall, which means any vertical flow in this borehole has to be diverted and passed through. You can see the screens here, okay? So this is the only tool that's not used in a nearly continuous manner. Most of the other tools I've shown, the video logs are definitely continuous. Caliper, temperature, gamma, things like that, they're nearly continuous. They're not really continuous, but they're very close. In this case, you would use your logs from your gamma, from your caliper log and your other logs that are indicating where you might have fractures in the well. And you would decide where to do your heat pulse discrete operations. So you would go down to a position in the well. You're looking at wanting to see what's right here. You got a fracture up here, maybe a fracture down here. You want to know what's going on between the two. That's when you'd run a heat pulse log. Okay, let's see. Let's go on. I'm sorry about my voice here. Allergy season. All right, back to our prime example. Here's your the gamma, caliper, acoustic, and optical televiewer. You have your temperature log here. Water is here. Okay, that's why we didn't have any acoustic until right here. These are your heat pulse locations, and as you can see, we kind of focused in to try to set them between what we see might be fractures. Here and here, we went to here. Between these two, we looked at this. We isolated right here at the top where we know we had cascading groundwater in the borehole. And your scale, in this case, this is minus 0.3 gallons a minute, this line here, plus 3/10 of a gallon a minute, and that's your line here, and that'd be zero, no flow, okay? Negative flow is downward flow. Positive flow is upward flow. So we see we have downward flow here. That's the flow meter telling us we have cascading water, and you'd expect it to be downward flow. Downward flow. A little bit more downward flow, so I think we got a little water coming in. And then between here and here, we lose a little bit. And I think we lose it in this zone that we depicted with the red horizontal line, probably losing a little bit here. So we're gaining a little bit coming down the borehole from the cascading water. We're picking up a little bit more water somewhere in here. And then no flow, okay? So there's your open void that we've seen, noted it with the temperature log. And it's clear to me that we have cascading water that's coming down, basically going and exiting the borehole here. Now you can understand what the implications are here. You know, if you've got a contamination in your shallow aquifer, you might be contaminating the lower aquifer that wasn't previously contaminated. So bear that in mind, because I come back to that. Okay. Also, what you can do with an acoustic televiewer is if you take it and you bend it back on itself again, connecting the zero line, the north line, in reverse, you come up with you can create a virtual core, which is what the core would look like if you had cored it, according to what was depicted in the, in this case, acoustic televiewer, optical televiewer. Okay, pretty neat. See how we got north oriented? We know where we are, and it just looks like a core. And also, this is a picture of the borehole wall. Okay, moving along. This is another good log that I like to run. It's a deviation log. And why is deviation logging important? If you know what the deviation is, you might be able to evaluate what kind of other tools you could get down the hole. Can you get a packer or assembly down a hole? And I've got some nice examples here. I think we'll be in lightning. Okay. Okay. If this log was, trying to find my arrow. There it is. If this log was totally perpendicular to the earth, it'd just be a red dot right there. Okay? This log, this hole is deviating in a pretty consistent way to the, almost to west, and it ran 130 feet over a 700-foot well. Okay? So I don't see any problem getting tools down this well, but it's not as straight as you might think. Okay. Here's the same hole, okay, but in cross-section view. And this would be towards the west. This well is in the front yard of a residence in a residential setting. Went down, and then it hit the foliation of metamorphic rock and ran with it, okay? Well, look how far it ran. Again, 140 feet. 40 feet run. So here's the front yard of the house that the well was in front of. Here's the road. Here's the house across the street. And the bottom of the hole is in this person's backyard. So when we look at a map and see a dot on it that says this is where your hole is, maybe not. If you're packing up this lower zone here, you're certainly not here. You'd be over here. Okay. Here's another one, just another way of visualizing it. In this case, it was a site in, the last site was in North Carolina. This site's in New York, near Albany. And you can see how it kind of corkscrews. So what happened is, this is overburden, glacial till. The well started by hitting a boulder or a cobble pretty high up and ran at an angle because of that boulder or cobble, hit the foliation of the bedrock or the metamorphic rock, and then ran back the other way. So you can see, could you get your packer assembly down this hole? We did. We didn't have a problem. But here's another example from the same site. Did the same thing. It went off to the northeast based upon a deflection due to a cobble over boulder, and then twisted and almost went due west. We had a heck of a time getting a packer assembly down that hole. So you can see the value of these so that you know what you're dealing with before you come out and mobilize to do packer testing. To what you might have in front of you. And again, the things I find the most use for in borehole logging is packer test design, how you would design a discrete zone assembly, such as a West Bay or a Flute or a Solanus. There's others as well. There's another technique out there, hydrophysics, basically also looking at those fractures that you would note in your formation logs to see where you would want to do that kind of testing. And also, I'll be talking about some of this in some groundwater case studies coming up. For those of you not familiar with a packer test, this would be a straddle packer test. You've got hard, rigid drilling pipe with a packer here. This is open to the formation. This is known because of your geophysics. And these packers inflate via a gas line from the surface. You can isolate this zone and just sample this water, not worrying about where any other water might be coming in from the well, either above or below. You can also packer test it with single packers. If you're just interested in knowing what's below a certain point or what's above a certain point, you might not need to use a straddle packer. You could just get by with one. Here's an example in the field. That's what a packer looks like. And this is being lowered into the well. You can see the gas line. You can affix pressure transducers on the pipe above, between the packers, and even below the packer, but you're not going to be able to see that data until you pull the assembly. But you can get real-time data from these zones, seeing what kind of drawdown, what kind of head loss you might have here, and see if you're affecting anything above or low. In other words, see if there's any connection. Okay. Let's see. I'm going to show you an example of a site, again, in upstate New York, and it was we used the West Bay system here, and this is a West Bay assembly, and you can see all of these lengths of pipe are different lengths. The blue, those are the packers. So what we've done is, based upon our geophysics, we've designed how we're going to set this assembly in the well. So we isolate, I think there were 6 or 8 zones in this well, and we were able to actually get head readings and samples from each zone independently, being all separate and sealed off. The design of this was based on the geophysics. Okay. Just a picture of a packer going down. This is a West Bay again. These packers aren't inflated with a gas. They're actually inflated by pressurized water. And when they get installed, they're hard to remove. I've had to do that in the past. They're pretty permanent installations. Okay, a couple of case studies here. I think you'll find these pretty interesting. This is a site in the center part of the island in Puerto Rico. And a well had been drilled in a very steeply incised valley right by a mountain creek. And as such, you can imagine that's probably been the reason the creek is there is because of fracturing, faulting. Okay. So here's a log from this hole. Here's your caliper log over here. And you see how we got a little bit of a kick here. We discerned the top of the casing, or the base of the casing, set right to here. Okay. Right below the casing, there's a big open zone. That's what this blue line is showing. That's what the caliper curve is showing. The blue line is your acoustic caliper. I don't know if they just didn't go deep enough to get past the fracturing, or the actual drilling resulted in fracturing of the upper rock there. But what you see here is, remember the last example of the heat pulse where there was dots on either side of a central line? In this case, they depicted it just by histograms. Okay? You see them here. This would be the position of the dot in the other depiction. Okay. So here we got an opening. You can see it in these logs. You can see it there. We got another opening down here at the bottom. So what do we have? Oh, downward flow. That was kind of expected, right? Now, this particular well was contaminated with TCE. And we know we saw it in the creek, but not at very high levels. but we did see it in the crate. So my suspicion was, well, what we did is we came in and did some packer testing. I isolated this zone here just with a single packer and pumped it pretty long, pumped it hard. And what we saw was concentrations that were indicative of what we saw in the well initially. And as we pumped, we did a series of analytical. And as we continued to pump, it eventually lowered and leveled out to where it was like five parts per million, a billion, when it was a couple hundred parts per billion up here. Then we packed this zone, okay, tested this, and we got the same number we were seeing in the well originally. And we did a series of pumping and sampling over time, and the concentrations just were the same. All right, so the interpretation here is that contaminated groundwater that was being allowed to come into the well was going down and going out in this lower zone and contaminating this aquifer. So what we did was during our packer testing, we also determined that when we had this packed off and this zone lower zone isolated, we were able to continue the pumping to the point where we got a good sense that that lower zone could in and of itself provide the required water for the community this well was serving. So the answer to this problem was we retrofitted this well, we sealed it off here so that there was only a pipe coming down through where we sealed it. We backfilled the backside with grout, and we're pumping only from this level now. And from 200 parts per billion, we got down to 5.5, I think it was. Not quite lower than the MCL, but I think over time it's going to clear up. And we might be talking years, but the carbon consumption on the treatment has been dramatically reduced. And the other benefit here was that this water that was coming in from this zone here was very high in total coliform. There's no total coliform down here. So by using the geophysics in conjunction with packer testing, we were able to retrofit this well, use this only the water from here, and ended up being able to give the community a much better source of water than they ever had. Okay. Now this is the groundwater site in upstate New York I've been talking about. The one with the big deviation was up near Albany. This site's over west of Syracuse, called the Cayuga County site. Okay. The site here, the PRP, the responsible party, had his operations right here. And you can see how the topography slopes towards the north. Groundwater at the site, both in front of this plant by this highway and behind it, all showed in the overburden water moving this way, and the shallow rock water moving this way. And they had some sentinel wells to the south, right along the road. I'm sorry, it'd be right here, right along the road. And these wells were into bedrock, and they were clean. And the evaluation was, well, all of our contamination is going off this way. In the meantime, the county health department detected some water in a contaminated water in a municipal well 7 miles. I wish I could turn that arrow around, 7 miles that way. And as they came back and worked up gradient or up topography, because this is very hilly terrain, they were getting hits. Some of these wells, see the ones in red, they're contaminated. The ones in blue aren't. So my suspicion here was that there was contamination coming emanating from the site and going down this way. Okay. So we put a series of wells in on the other side of Genesee Street, right here. We put some more in here, some more in here. And then we use the base elevation for those wells as being somewhere in the same elevation as where these wells that were contaminated were at elevation-wise. So we went to about 500 feet elevation. Okay. This is what we found. You remember this hole. Standard, my example here. Again, downward flow, cascading water, open zone here, right? water going out here. So the responsible party accused us, the EPA, of by opening this well and in letting water come in from the shallow zone, that we were pulling contaminated water from their site, and we were actually allowing it to get down in this lower aquifer. But what did Packer testing tell us? Well, I packed these zones off, this zone here, and I found contamination in the shallow water that was entering the well and cascading down. Packed this off. Some of these didn't really make any water. I think this one did a little bit. And when I packed this upper zone off, we did a time series analysis again on the analytical. We pumped 10 volumes, 20 volumes, 50 volumes, 100 volumes. Number was always the same. And that was the same number that we were seeing in the borehole. But when I packed off this zone here and we started pumping, again, we did a series of analytical sampling over time. And the initial number was the same as what we were here, as what we were seeing up here. But this case, it was reverse. As we continued to pump, right, the concentrations went down to the point where they almost zeroed out into nothing. So what we were doing here, what was happening here is, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. This water was clean. And that what was happening is the water came down, this well, this was contaminated. This is when I pumped it time after time after time. I got the same number. This was always clean, 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 clean. So what was happening in this well was that clean water was being introduced, allowed to come down into this open void. It was basically diluting the sample. So that if I had put a pump in this well, without knowing the geology, without knowing the vertical flow, without knowing where the fractures were, you could just put a pump of that well, and you would say that there was no contamination in it. But when you isolated this zone, that's where the contamination was or is. Okay. Sorry, I got that backwards for a second. All right, advancing here. So again, in the upper zone, the shallow zone, overburdened shallow rock, contamination and groundwater was flowing this way. But in the end, it's actually going, these are our wells here that we put in. Flow is going, and then that way, and down that way, 7 more miles until it hits the lake. So you can see how valuable the borehole geophysics was in being able to evaluate an open hole. Subsequent to that, all these holes were retrofit with multi-level discrete zone sampling strings. So now there is no mixing, there's no dilution of the plume. We have monitoring points in 7 or 8 vertical positions within each of the boreholes. Okay. This is your bonus here. I've done a lot of oil and gas well abandonment out in western Kentucky, holes that vary in size from 500 to 2,500 feet deep. And what we found useful out there were two types of logs. Well, three, counting the gamma. The gamma log was important, but the casing collar locator logs, either a magnetic log. And they help us to identify where the lengths of steel pipe are joined together. And cement bond logs help us to see how well the casings are cemented in place. Next slide. And here's an example. This is your gamma log. And what we wanted to do is try to protect the more sandy zones, which are depicted by gamma's out in this range here, more sandy. This is shalier here. This is the example of a casing collar locator log. It's a magnetic log. It tells you how much metal is there, steel. And you can see how there's these almost uniform kicks. See that? Those are casing collars. There's another one. There's another one. That's where the lengths of pipe are joined together. The rest of this is kind of, we call it ratty zones. They're not collars, but they've been on the ground so long and they just have been corroded and rust, and they just give a little bit more signal than a clean piece of pipe. So we knew where the collars are. We knew where the sand is. We want to protect the sand here and here. This is a cement bond log. This curve here and these depictions over here. When you see something like this, when you see the note that says top cement, this pipe is cemented in to about 260 feet. You can tell that by the separation of these two different responses on your sonic log, and then how it's shown in like this. That's a good cement job. This is not a good cement job. So in order to get the best possible seal we could get here, we identified where we wanted to shoot this casing off and pull it from the hole. So we know we have good cement around the pipe from this position down. That's all good cement. All we have to do is fill up the pipe there, and we got a good seal. But here, if we just filled up the pipe, we might not get a good seal. We like to get pipe out when we can. So based on the casing collar log, we identified this collar, the one that was just above the top of cement, to be shot off. And what we do is we use an explosive charge. And you want to shoot at a collar because that's the easiest place to break a casing with explosives. And what we would do is tape on some TNT, lower it down. The logging truck runs this and actually fires the explosive. And we run it down to that point. We hook a wire onto the casing that we're going to shoot off. We set the charge off, and then we pull the casing out, and then we fill up the hole from bottom up and get a good cement seal both inside and behind the casing, or the casing's gone, actually. So we get the best possible seal. Okay. Here's another example. Sandier zones, gamma log. High counts, low counts. In this case, the casing was cemented here behind the casing from 40 feet to surface. But from this point down, there's no cement. This is problematic because we can't shoot the casing off because it's cemented in place. How do we get a good seal between this casing and the borehole wall from this point down? Again, we want the best seal we can down near the pay zone because that's where the oil's where it's coming into the well, coming up and leaking. So take a note of this casing collar log. See the casing collars. You see a much cleaner casing. This casing wasn't nearly as corroded. So we see the double line here saying good cement. We got good cement here. No cement here. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to look at the sandier zones, and we would perforate this casing using directional charges. And we picked here, here, and here, again, corresponding with our sandier zones. And it's three shots, and they're directional. They go in probably 120 degrees apart as you look down on them. And we don't want to shoot at a casing collar because we don't want to break it. We just want to shoot a hole in it. Shoot a hole in it and shoot a hole in it, okay? And this is the same assembly being lowered in by via the logging truck. In this case, here are your directional charges. And what they do is you go down to the point where you want to perforate the casing. Perforate, and we perforated three shots, three times, so we have good holes in the water or in the pipe. And then we're able to pump cement in through the pipe, pushing out between the casing and the borehole wall beneath where the cement was in the upper zone, and then filling the rest of the pipe up and getting, again, the best vertical seal we can get with our cement job. And that's that for that. Oh, yeah. You have a URL link embedded in one of the screens that Gene was mentioning. It's titled Kentucky Oil Wells Plugging. It's an ERTV video that was made years ago when I was much younger and we were working in the oil fields out there in Kentucky. And if you go this route or you click on the URL link that Gene provided, you can see a short video on that. It's about 25 minutes in duration. And with that, conclusion. If you know your borehole, you can help yourself make a lot of good calls and good decisions in the field. All right, Gene, I got 18 minutes for questions if anybody wants any.
All right, excellent. So just a reminder for those participants who may not have yet submitted their question, you can type them up electronically using the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. We've already had several questions already come in, so I'm going to start with the ones that have already been submitted. But again, you can continue to type in questions and comments as we go through those in the queue, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have allotted. So I had one question that came earlier on when you were referencing connectivity logging. One participant would like if you could explain how the connectivity logging works.
So look, it's a tool that measures the electrical conductivity or resistivity. So it's an electric log. And it says based on the responses, the more conductive, there's a transmitter and a receiver portion of the tool, and it's giving off a signal, and it's measuring a reply electrical signal, and the higher the conductivity, the less response you're going to get, and the more the conductivity, the most response you'll get. So, I'm not that's not my tool. I don't like to use it a lot. I find it very valuable to seeing bases of casings. When your steel casings are, and that's a good use for it for me because it's clearly a distinctive difference between steel casing and a borehole. So that was actually Jim Ursic's tool, and I forgot to mention this. Jim Ursic out of Region 5 in Chicago is giving a demonstration on borehole logging. Anybody in Chicago is. In the area, could give Jim a call, and maybe you can make arrangements to go see the logging. His number is 312-353-1526, and it's ursic.james@epa.gov. Ursic is spelled U-R-S-I-C, and it's in the Chicago area on October 2nd. I hope that answers the question.
Okay. We've had a couple of questions that have come in regarding non-traditional wells, and these are mostly for wells that didn't go in at a completely vertical hole. So one of our first questions on that topic asks, regarding those wells that drifted or corkscrewed, do you know what type of drill rig was used to install those wells, and if they noticed or had difficulties with that in the field?
These wells were installed prior to our involvement in the site. Again, they were resident. Well, the ones in North Carolina with the really big deviation. The ones in New York, yeah, we drilled those. And we were drilling using an air hammer. And I think we could have had better success if we had cored it. But I think we did core a hole, and we still got the same deviation. We might have had not as much at the top through the till, but once it hit that foliation, It was just preferentially soft that direction, and it just turned over and went that way. Sonic drilling might have been different too, but that's a lot more expensive, and I still think it would have deviated that far. The one in North Carolina, I don't know how they were drilled. I think that they were drilled with air hammer or air rotary.
Okay. Again, we had a somewhat similar question, and this one, they just wanted to know exactly which tools could you use in an angled borehole?
Well, you can use all, most of them. The thing you have to remember is that in an angled borehole, which basically every borehole is, if it's any depth in rock, you know, your tool is going to be laying on one side of the borehole as it's going down. You might want to consider centralizers that keep it centered. And if you got a real big bend in your borehole, like I showed you in that one tool, in that one hole, we weren't able to use conventional packer testing there. We had to go from a packer test, packers that were attached to a solid drilling rod, to a packers that were wire lined and lowered down via a wire. So you have to look at what you have and make a call. In this case, I didn't even try to go down that hole with a a standard packer assembly on drilling rod. I knew we wouldn't make it.
All right, excellent. We've had a couple of people ask, I think the question that's usually prevalent when we talk about particular technologies, how much does this cost?
I will say this, and this is the, you spend $10,000-$20,000 to drill a well or a hole, and it's an exploratory hole. In other words, you're not going into a setting where you really know what the geology is. You know what depths you're targeting. That's not where this is used. This is using, you would use this more in a setting where you're trying to find out what's there and then be able to determine how you might want to finish your well, whether with multi-level assemblies or just standard setting a well and then drilling another one next to it at a different depth for a nested pair. It's probably about $5,000 a well, and it depends on the depth of the well and things like that, but it's really not that much of a cost considering what the cost you spent in drilling the well. And it just gives you so much more to go on.
Okay. Our next question, get into the depths of the wells. A couple of people just wanted to know exactly how deep are the wells that you're using this technology on. And then we had another participant that kind of clarified. They wanted to confirm, are these boreholes really 180 feet deep? They want to know if it's common practice to drill boreholes in the U.S. across multiple strata, especially when you might have potential contamination in the groundwater without installing seals from one unit to another. So can you just clarify the depths in that particular case study you were using?
Right. Well, the depths, you can geophysically log holes that are thousands of feet deep. They do it all the time in the oil industry. We're talking 20,000 feet deep. But you're not going to be using these types of tools in those deep oil wells. So the depth isn't really an issue. You might be limited by a certain vendor's, the electric line that he hangs the tools off of and runs down the hole. He might only have a certain amount of length. But that doesn't really matter. As far as drilling holes open, yeah, if you're in an area where you know that you've got a sandy zone or a conduit flow system that's contaminated, and you know pretty much what you have. No, you're not going to drill deep open holes like that. You're gonna go in and you're going to case down. If you want to go deeper than that zone, you're going to case that off and telescope down, or you're going to target that particular zone if that's what you're looking for, to delineate where that plume might be horizontally. But if you're in an area where you don't have any idea what you've got except for, say, there's residential wells that are contaminated, okay, and you're out there and you're trying to figure out what the geologic setting is, you do this deeper. You do put a well in. I put it in as deep as I think I need to. Then you log it with sampling, and if you've got to retrofit it or complete it, you could do it quickly. It might be open for a couple of a month or so, but, you know, that's – we're talking vertical flows that aren't really that great, and if these private wells are already contaminated, I don't know how much you're exacerbating the system, but you know you do want to retrofit these wells. Eventually, they get completed. All these open hole wells, except for the residential wells we were logging in North Carolina, all these open hole wells were converted subsequent to their installation.
Okay. We have a couple of questions that are coming in, again, more honing in on limitations or situations where they can and cannot be applied. So the first set of questions want to know about temperature limitations or ranges. And they want to know, are there any limitations with the borehole tests when they are used in wells with higher temperatures, such as low-temperature geothermal wells?
Low temperature, I don't think, would be an issue. You're not going to want to put it in boiling water from a, you know, in a geyser type setting. I've never had an issue with any well I've ever drilled with temperature logs being unuseful. But I guess if the groundwater is really hot, I would check with the either the manufacturer of the particular temperature tool that you'd be using or with the vendor that's going to be contracted to do the work and see what the specifications of that tool are and what its upper range might be. But I haven't seen a problem with temperature logging.
Okay.
But there's a lot of geologic settings out there.
Okay. We had another participant that wanted to know, and this is limitations. What are the limitations for using these tools in small diameter holes? In other words, something that might be 4 inches or smaller.
Everything that I showed you today, I ran in 4-inch holes. Okay. You get down to 3-inch holes, you're going to have a lot of trouble. And if you get down to 2-inch holes, I mean, who puts a 2-inch bedrock borehole in? Not many people. I mean, you might complete it with a 2-inch PVC casing. But your holes are typically going to be 4 inches at least, nominally 4 inches. And I haven't had any problem with any of these tools. You know, I use a lot of vendors, and there's a lot of – and one thing I didn't mention is – and I was thinking about mentioning it, but there's just so many vendors out there that I didn't want to mention a long list of people who make these equipment, these tools, because there's lots of them. You might find some that are specializing in smaller diameter holes. I've never had to look for one. But the tools I've run and get on these examples were all in 4-inch holes or bigger.
Okay. We have a couple of questions that are coming in terms of the hole. What if it's dry? Can you use any of these logging types in dry holes, something that doesn't actually have water in it?
Yeah. First of all, I don't know why you'd want to, but you know, you might. You can't use the acoustic tools, and that would be the acoustic televiewer or the sonic cement bond log tools. They have to have water or fluid in the hole because the sound perpetuates from the tool, hits the borehole, and comes back, and it can only do that when there's a fluid in the hole, right? Most of the other ones you can run in dry holes. Heat pulse flow meter, you couldn't because there's no vertical flow because there's no water. You couldn't run the. You could run the acoustic televiewer. You could run the cameras, the gamma, the temperature, the caliper. All those tools could be conductivity, resistivity. They could all be run in a dry hole.
Okay.
There's one other thing I wanted to start, and I forgot to mention, EPA is doing a lot of work in Region 3 because I've been approached by them. About their underground injection control programs, and they're very well interested in those cement bond logs. And cement bond logs can be used in multiple fashions, not just in the oil business. If you want to make sure your cement seal is good, you can log the hole, and sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not.
Okay.
I thought I'd just throw that out there. I forgot to say that.
We actually had a comment that came in on the cement bond logs, and this participant says that a producer recently told me that cement bond logs deliver a lot of false positive readings, for example, readings indicating that there are problems in the hole, and that it causes them to blow holes in perfectly good casings and then repair it to conditions not as good as the original. If this false positive error does occur with a cement bond log, is there some way to minimize it?
Well, you know, I don't operate the tools. I contract it out, and the people I've had working with us have been very, very good at doing the interpretive work. I probably have plugged 300 to 400 wells in Western Kentucky and Tennessee, and I don't think I've ever had really an issue, but I don't, you know, if there was cement there, you're not really, if you try to blow a hole in a casing that there is cement behind, the projectile's not really going to go anywhere. I don't, and that there would be a hole in the steel, I guess, but where would any fluid go if there's cement there? I don't think you're destroying the cement bond or the cement seal. But I think that'd be a question for an expert who knows how to interpret that data.
Okay. This is a question in terms of decontamination. They want to know if there are any special considerations for decontamination of the geophysical tools that you're using in these investigations.
Nothing really that's more different than decontaminating anything else you put down a hole. You don't want to take tools and put them in an oil environment and then expect to go to a groundwater well and not have some type of, because that's really hard to decontaminate anything with an apple. But the tools, they're sealed. They don't, nothing enters them. You clean the line up as you're coming out of the hole, you clean the line and then you decontaminate the tools.
Okay.
Standard decontamination.
A couple of questions on your deviations. One question asked, on the standard deviation demonstration, you showed about 130 feet of deviation for a 700-foot well.
Yes.
And they commented that that seems like a lot. What would be considered acceptable deviation in that situation?
Unfortunately, in that situation, there was nothing. I mean, we didn't drill those wells. And even if we had, we did drill some that weren't that deep, but they ran all in that direction too. It was just based on the geology, and it's nothing you really could do. The good thing in that hole was that the deviation was pretty consistent from surface down, so you were able to do everything in the well that you needed to do. It's just that the base of the well was in the backyard of the neighbor across the street, and you just have to, you know, sometimes that might be important. I guess, my answer.
Okay. For deviation logging, wouldn't it be better to represent the same scale on the vertical and horizontal axes? Otherwise, it looks like a greater percentage of the drilled depth.
Maybe so. Yeah, that's your standard vertical exaggeration in the cross section. These wells, these deviation logs that I showed you were actual submittals to me from subcontractors to my prime contractor, and I didn't really have any input on the scales. Sounds like something reasonable. You could I'm sure you could ask them to do that, and they would do it that way.
Okay. Let's move on to a couple of other questions here. One of them wants to know, what type of resistivity tool was used? Did you use induction or normal?
I wanted to throw a slide in on that process, on that method, just because it was something I thought maybe some people would be interested in. Jim Ersick ran that, did that evaluation, and I'm not sure exactly what tool he used.
Okay. We got another question. How do you assure quality logging? What are your standard operating procedures?
Well, the tools are they're sent to the manufacturer on a periodic basis for calibration. There's a calibration process you use when you're doing a mechanical caliper. You actually calibrate that in the field using a stainless steel template that has little dimples in it where you set the arms and you tell the computer that this is this many inches, that is that many inches. Most of the other tools are something you're not really going to open up. So you need to periodically have someone who builds them and knows how to get into their workings look at them and certify that they're good. With a subcontractor, I just expect that they do that. But you know, if you look at the acoustic or the optical televiewer and you see a slice going through at an angle, I mean, that's there. And so I'm just assuming that most of those tools are calibrated according to manufacturer specifications.
Okay, we are coming close to our scheduled end time of 2:15 p.m. I'm going to take two more questions here, and then we'll close things out today. So our next question asks, have you ever used brine tracing with temperature and electrical conductivity monitoring to locate transmissive fractures?
No, I haven't myself, because being a contaminant hydrogeologist at EPA, I'm usually dealing with groundwater contamination from chemicals. But I do know that that work is done, and it's definitely possible and doable, and it is done.
Okay. And our last question that we'll take live during today's webinar, one of our attendees would like to know if there are any books or additional classes and trainings on this topic if they'd like to learn more.
One of the pioneers in the industry, Dr. Keyes, K-E-Y-S, I actually attended a short course with him. I know he's retired. I'm not sure he's alive, but he was really the pioneer in this work. And the course I took from him back in the late 1980s was called Borehole Geophysics for Groundwater. Dr. Keyes would probably be a reference to some of his material, would probably be a much greater in-depth description and explanation of these things than I just gave you in an hour. And I'm sure if you Googled on or Yoohooed or whatever your browser is, you know, groundwater, you'd be at geophysics and with borehole applications. I'm sure that you'd come up with some good references.
All right, excellent. Don, any final statements you'd like to leave the audience with before I walk through our closeout procedures today?
No, I just appreciate the time, and thank you for everybody for coming on.
All right, excellent. I want to echo Don's gratitude as well. We had nearly 450 people join us from all over the world for today's live broadcast. We did share links in our Q&A window as well as in the related URLs pod where you can provide feedback as well as access materials that we used in today's session. So again, for those of you looking for copies of the materials or wanting to provide feedback on today's webinar, please follow those links and do so now. Just a few final reminders before we close things out today. We often get requests for training records or lists of webinars that people have participated in. We do have a free automated email system that you can visit at cluin.org/training/records. And if you enter in your own email address, we'll actually send you an automated table by email that lists all of the webinars that you attended live under that email address. We're working to include recorded webinars that you've replayed, but we don't have that functioning yet. So it'll at least give you a list of all the live events you've attended. If you need additional help, you can certainly contact me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov. As I mentioned, we do have copies of the presentation materials as well as the videos that were played back, including the Kentucky Oil Wells plugging video that Don referenced earlier, listed on our resources page. For those of you that are replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, that link is still active under the related URLs pod on the far right, so you can simply click that and press the Browse To button to open up the seminar resources page. And then I will ask each of you to take just a moment and fill out our short online feedback form. We continue to rely upon feedback from our audience to continue to offer Cluin Internet seminars such as this one. Let us know what you thought both of the technical content that we presented today as well as the actual technology that we used to host today's live webinar. We're always looking to improve the session, so we do count on those comments to come in. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can actually fill out their own online feedback form. Once you fill that form out, there'll be a link that appears that will ask the next person to hop on and fill out their own feedback form. For those of you that are looking to document your attendance for CEUs or PDHs, while we don't issue independent certificates for each of our webinars, you may be able to earn credit for attending today's live broadcast from your crediting institution. If you save your registration email and either print out a copy of the seminar homepage or the materials that were used, and fill out feedback. On that feedback form, there's a box you can check that as long as your email address and your name are entered correctly, we will send you an automated confirmation email that will at least verify you submitted feedback after the live delivery was held. So if you take that along with those other items, such as the homepage or the seminar materials, that's usually enough to earn credit for CEUs or PDHs. Again, that also applies for those of you replaying the recorded version. You can still fill out the online feedback form after today's live broadcast. So again, I want to thank Don Bussey, who joined us from EPA's Environmental Response Team, for providing a wonderfully technical session today. And again, the 450 of you who joined us from around the world, I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and we will see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN webinar. You will receive an automated email as soon as the recording of today's live broadcast is available for free replay, and I encourage you to share that with other professionals that you think will find it useful. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.